Good evening, everybody.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us again tonight. Tonight's lesson is a fascinating one, applicable to everyone equally. I think some of our previous lessons had some elements that some people can relate to more than others. This is one that is equally applicable to everyone here. It's a very profound lesson, one that I personally found intriguing. So I hope that we will all thoroughly enjoy it. Just quickly, a recap of last week's lesson before we begin. This week, we're going to do a quick recap. Last week, nothing like good Java. Last week, we covered the concept of home versus house. We started the evening with a quick poll. We polled everybody in the room. What do you think about when you hear the word home? What do you think about when you hear the word house? It was pretty evident that everybody was on the same page. House is a shelter, a place where you keep your stuff. It's a place where, it's a place. Home is your place. It's a place where you feel comfortable. It's a place where you make a home for others to come and feel part of your home, in essence. It's a more of a spiritual place. So we made a differentiation between the spiritual home and the physical home, the physical house. And we discussed the concept of our personal homes, in essence, as a microcosm of the divine home and the cosmic plan of all of humanity. And the importance of making our own homes, not just a house, a physical place. And, you know, we asked everybody, have you ever walked into a house and felt extremely uncomfortable? It could be a beautiful house, a mansion, but you just feel that it's cold, something's lacking. And then sometimes we walk into a house that's far from beautiful. Very simple. Yet, it's comforting. You walk in and you feel at home. You feel the people are welcoming. So the idea is to make your home a place where other people feel welcome. But first and foremost, it's important to make yourself and your family feel welcome. And that it should be a place where everybody can get together and good evening, and truly interact with each other on a positive note. And we discussed how sometimes the central element of a home becomes electronics or a TV. And you know, we have this chronic problem, specifically in today's day and age, where people are always on their electronic gadgets and people don't talk to each other anymore. So the importance of, you know, shutting things down and communicating with people in your family and making it what a home really should be. And then we ended the evening with discussing three central ideas that make a home truly a peaceful place. One, relationships, to make sure that the people that all live under one roof interact with each other on a positive plane. Very possible for many people to just live under one roof, but that's it. They kind of don't communicate with each other, which is unhealthy. Number two is the atmosphere. The home needs to be inviting and comfortable. And we're not talking about physical, being physically inviting. It has to be inviting spiritually, so people feel like this is a positive atmosphere. And finally, function. Simply to have things in order. Right, people have to know, you know, the kids know that they have to clean up after themselves and put things in the hamper, put things in my house. It's chores, right? When they finish eating, they're supposed to clear up after themselves. I have in my house something called CTP, complete the process. Anything you do has to be completed. You take cereal out of the pantry, it has to go back. It's got to make a full circle. So we have that in my house, the kids know. CTP, complete the process. Whatever it is, make sure you...
That's how you define the task. The task is to make a big mess.
Right.
I did.
But the idea is that it has to be order as well. That people have to know that everything has to run smoothly and not be chaos. That was last week. This week, and the objectives of tonight's lesson, is to understand how work is integral to the human being. We're going to compare, as we've done in previous classes, the common perception of why we work, and then we're going to compare that to the Torah idea of what the meaning of work is. And we're going to touch upon the idea, a fundamentally important idea, maybe even a radical idea, that work can be inherently spiritual. And work, in essence, must be inherently spiritual. And we're going to discuss how and why that is. We're going to come across a fresh perspective on work and retirement, or lack thereof. We're going to talk about the concept of retirement. Does Judaism agree with, 65 and that's it, we're done? Or is there something beyond that? And finally, we're going to end with practical tools for enriching our day-to-day work. And we're going to discover the importance of giving to others. The importance of not just working for your own idea, for your own, for yourself, but also working so that you can then have to give to others, to be charitable. So, let's start with tonight's video. Get the popcorn out.
Something of value in return. So why would a businessman give away a dollar or 10 million if there was no tangible return on the investment? Meet Mr. Gennady Fodorubov, a self-made billionaire. He was raised in Ukraine during communist rule, and although he was Jewish, he first met a rabbi and visited a synagogue at age 34. In 1995, Mr. Bogolubov's business partner told him that the local rabbi wanted to invite them to his home for dinner. Bogolubov wondered how they would benefit from the meeting.
Supplying the food, we have a lot of food. Supplying the relationship, so whether we need it. And I refused, we didn't go. A few weeks after, he came to me again. It's a big friend of mine. He says it's not only food, it's not only a relationship. It's a good person, and we decided to go.
At dinner, the rabbi invited Bogolubov to join him the next day at the synagogue. At the back of the synagogue, Bogolubov noticed a shabby room where about 20 people were sitting and eating. The rabbi explained that it was a free soup kitchen, and whoever wanted could come and eat. Bogolubov was skeptical.
My question was, but how do you know they really need? Maybe they have enough money, enough food at home, but just want to challenge you, just want to eat for free. He looked at me seriously, and he asked me a question which changed my life. Can you come and ask for food? I said, no. He said, if someone comes and asks, he really needs. This changed my life.
The next day, Mr. Bogolubov returned to the synagogue and donated $10,000. Since then, he has given tens of millions to charities around the world. Amongst many projects, the Bogolubov Foundation funds meals for 1,000 Jewish school children in Vienna and is constructing a Jewish cultural center in Ukraine that will be the largest in the world.
And everything I can explain, why did I do that? Everything I can say, besides that $10,000. Because it was unexplainable. Because in that time, our business means we have to go and take and put in the pocket. But to do the reverse, backward, it was against the nation. I did it and it changed my life.
Join us this week as we explore work, wealth, and giving, how it can change our lives and the lives of those around us.
Nadi Bogolubov.
What does he do? Bogolubov is a very Russian name. It's not a Jewish.
It's Gottlieb.
Huh?
Bogolubov means Gottlieb. What does he do? He's in Gaz Energy. It's actually my brother-in-law that was the rabbi that we're talking about.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wait,
they're building now the biggest Jewish community center in the world.
In what, you said?
Ukraine.
No, what did you do?
Oh, Gaz, natural gas.
Yeah.
You know, right place at the right time. It's worth about $15 billion. Pretty. So, the question we're going to start with tonight is, why do we work? Everyone sitting here either works or worked at some point in their lives, whether it's blue collar, whether it's white collar. Work consumes a major part of our lives. So let's just, for a moment, take a quick poll. Go around the room. Just tell us, why do we work? What's the objective in one sentence?
To make a living.
To make a living. Good.
Same.
Rapidly changing.
Rapidly.
Hopefully they're going to change even more after tonight. Good. So you're going to pass?
Well, I used to work to make money for my bills. You know, I used to work to use something.
Change the work. Good. Okay. The altruistic something. Okay.
The first 20 years was to maximize wealth and quality of life.
I'm what?
Maximize
wealth.
To thereby enhance the quality of life.
Enhance your quality of life. Okay.
Well, I guess all of those for sure. I think it depends on kind of where you are in your life. You know. I guess sometimes I think people that really don't need to go to make a living just go to have a schedule and have friendships and social and if they don't really need the money, you will, you know, get to other people. Not that they need the money to give to others, but it's just a number of things.
It's a combination of things.
Mm-hmm.
Many things, good.
Well, of course, I needed a paycheck, but at the same time, I wanted to make the most of it. I wanted to... the society to benefit from my work, it gave me satisfaction and personal joy.
Okay.
I work because I like to contribute to what I do. I never had to really make a living at it, so I did things that I loved doing. And at the same time, I thought I was bringing a service when I was a musician when I was younger. I used to do it because I loved doing it, but also because I thought there was a benefit to those people that were hearing my musician. I work now. I don't have to work. I just love doing it. And I love the context and the environment that I'm in.
Good.
Keep MasterCard
happy. To keep MasterCard happy. There you go.
and all the other creditors. Well, that's true. I mean, I work to earn a living now. I think if it wasn't for the need to earn a living, I'd probably do different work. You know, I'd still work, and there would be other reasons.
All the answers that we all discussed, we're going to, over the evening, see how they actually all play an important part in our lives. And we're also going to give them all a spiritual dimension. So let's for a second go to the introduction.
Okay. Have you ever dreamed about winning the lottery and how it might change your life? Almost everyone needs to work to make ends meet. Indeed, work consumes most of the hours of our day. But is our work more than it means to pay our bills and purchase whatever our hearts desire? What kind of people would we be if we did not need to work
to live. Some of us have made our work the center of our lives. This is healthy. Others loathe work and see it as an unwanted burden. Is this healthy? In this lesson, we will examine new ways to think about work and wealth, and above all, how to make work an integral and integrated component of our search for a meaningful life.
Okay, so now we're going to go to page 88. We'll do learning activity number one. Quickly, let's just complete the following short questionnaire. What do these questions tell you about your own work values? Think of work in general. Circle one number for each statement below to show how much you agree or disagree with each. One is strongly disagree, five is strongly agree. Let's just quickly, if everybody just, you know, grab a pen. A job is just a way of earning money, no more. On a scale of 1 to 5, who would you quantify that? I would enjoy having a job even if I did not need the money.
It depends what kind of job.
Okay, again, so assuming it's a job that, if you don't need the money, obviously, you can choose any job you want if you don't need the money. So, in other words, assuming that it's a job of your choice. Okay, and finally, work is a person's most important activity. Where would you put that on 1 to 5? So I, for instance, I did 2, 4, and 5. That's how I scored it. And the reason why I scored 5 on the last one is because I already went through the material tonight. So hopefully by the time we're done, you will score 5 on the last one, although I'm assuming most of you didn't score on the last question 5.
There's a saying, if you love your job, you never have to work a day in your life.
It's interesting on that last question.
Right, but the point of tonight's, what we're trying to get to is that work has intrinsic value. And that's what we're going to get to. So I'm sure you're all familiar with this, right?
You made many, many poor people. I realize, of course, it's no shame to be poor, but it's not great honor either. And what would have been so terrible if I had the small fortune?
If I were a rich man, all day long, if I were a wealthy man, I would have to work out. If I were a idle man, I'd build a big tall house with rooms by the dozen right in the middle of the town. A fine tin roof with real wooden floors below. There would be one long staircase just going up, and one even longer coming down, and one more leading nowhere just for show. My yard with chicks and birdies and geeks and ducks for the town to see and hear. Talking just as noisily as they can.
I think we got the point, yeah?
And it's
so here we have Fiddler on the Roof, right? Famous At Aptevia, right? So, if we were to win the lottery tomorrow, would the average person quit work? It's a famous question that people are always being asked. Would you or wouldn't you? You know, today most people, at least in countries like the United States of America, don't actually endure back-breaking labor, like Tevye had to in the shtetl. Even blue-collar workers today don't go through what they went through. But there are other miseries to work, right? There are long hours, oppressive bosses, right? You know, the famous Jackie Mason piece. He says, you know, you ever met a Gentile when he's talking about his boss? You know, try to put on the Jackie Mason thing. His boss is a ticket to the next, to up the corporate ladder. My boss is the greatest guy. He's a nice person. I go golfing with him. You ever met a Jew talk about his boss? That scoundrel. We always try to. I've very seldom met somebody who liked their boss. Then you have competition, backstabbing within, you know, competitive people within offices. This is white collar. We all know that. Then you have abusive customers if you're running a store. We all, you know, the pressures and the various challenges to work, although they may not be backbreaking, are definitely there. So once a person has enough money, why would they continue working? Why would a person want to put up?
Is this part of improving the world, making it better?
It's part of it. But in essence, first let's talk about the common understanding, right? That there are other reasons to work besides money.
Because you identify what you do so much with your work.
People start identifying themselves with their work, which...
But I don't think that the person, once they have money, would any longer put up with, as you named earlier, the boss that they dislike, dwelling on something they never liked. They could confuse yourself, confuse yourself, that a man who is engaged in labor of love never works again in his life.
Yeah.
So it might work.
But anything you're going to do, okay, again, anything that's classified as work, there's going to be challenges, even if it's a labor of love.
Right.
You're going to run into challenges, and you're going to run into people that, and into scenarios that are uncomfortable. It's just the nature of the beast. Unless you isolate yourself in some island, and all you do is play the violin all day, and then it's arguable if that's really work, right?
Right,
but
20% of the job is that, 80% all really good.
Okay, but again, for even that 20%, the point is that there's going to be some uncomfortable situations in anything any human being does, if it's on the level of something that has interaction with others, which would be something that's classified as work. So the question now is, why would a person continue working? So let's first talk about, there are other benefits to work besides for money. They have a common understanding of the various benefits that come with work. Let's stick with text number 2.
I have a question.
Yeah.
In Genesis, work is like a punishment. Adam and Eve, you know, they sinned, and now they're going to have to earn their daily bread by the work of their... I forgot exactly how it's worded, but they were living the good life. They didn't have to work. They were in Eden. And because they sinned, now they're going to have to, you know... So how does that fit in with this?
It's a good question, okay, and it's out of the scope of this class, but there's different definitions, right?
Mm-hmm.
When it says that, and we covered this in a class about 2-3 years ago, I think you were at it, what does it mean that they weren't working before and now mm-hmm. they're working, or maybe they were working before and now they aren't, with what the definition of work is.
Yeah.
They were working before, but then they got the money.
They were demoted, that's right. They got a pay cut. So text number 2. Who started? Who read? You read? Where'd we start from this side? Ruby. Yeah, go ahead.
It does not seem to be true. It doesn't necessarily mean to be unpleasant. In many, it may also have to be hard, or at least harder than doing nothing at all. But there is ample evidence that work can be enjoyable and that indeed it is often the most enjoyable part of life.
Let's look at learning activity number two. Okay? There are many different reasons why a person would go to work. Let's look at the benefits on the bottom. It allows you to avoid boredom. If you have to sit at home all day, you'd pull your hair out. It gives you a feeling of accomplishment. Provides you with social interaction. Provides you with a feeling of being useful or important. Provides you with new challenges. Gives you an opportunity to express your talents. Gives you a chance to be appreciated by others. Gives you an opportunity to learn interesting things about people, facts, and ideas. So these are all things that are beyond just making money. You know, there's a story told about a nobleman who one day was traveling and he saw a serf, and the serf was with a sickle standing in the field, and the sound was very soothing to the nobleman. So he stops the serf and says, "Can you tell me how much you make a day?" So the guy tells him, "A ruble." And he made nothing. What's a ruble a day? It's like he made a dollar a day. So the nobleman says, "Why don't you come to my palace? Why don't you stand in my room and make the sound, and I'll pay you 10 ruble a day. 10 times. So the guy goes, "Great idea." Goes to the palace, and after 2 days he gets up one more, he goes to the nobleman and says, "I quit." The nobleman says, "I don't understand. I'm paying you 10 times as much, and you don't even have to, you know, there's no real labor involved anymore either." So the man tells him, something very profound. He says that I would rather do something and be productive than get paid money for something that absolutely bears no fruit. In other words, a human being in his very essence cannot do something that's not going to produce anything. Cannot just sit there day after day going through the same motions but doesn't see the labor of his fruit. So he quit. Said, "Have a nice day. It's not going to work. I'd rather get one ruble and work harder than get 10 rubles and do nothing with my life." So the best workers ultimately are motivated by things that are beyond money, things that are more important than money. Let's look at text number 3. Regina.
"Do not hire men without you work for money, but him that is for love of them. How do you know?"
That's the million-dollar question. That's where professional managers come in. Mm-hmm. But so in other words, work is there to fulfill a need. People work ultimately for a benefit, whether it's personal, financial, emotional, intellectual. People sacrifice their time and effort to receive something greater in return. That's the basic principles of work. And this selfish motivation is not bad. Ultimately, it results in advances in all fields, in science, in medicine, right? If not for the fact that a person, on some level, was doing things for their own selfish needs, then many of the medications we have today would not exist. Many of the great scientific revolutions would have never happened. Let's look at text 4a. Which underscores this idea.
Were it not for the needs of people, the earth would not be worth to yield its fruit or fruit and crop. The items that are extracted from the earth, such as gold, silver, precious stones, medicinal ingredients, and dyes, would have never been yielded. It goes without saying that no one would be willing to travel on ships and trek the deserts to bring bread from afar to kill the deprivation of the states that lack grain, expensive items, spices, etc. There would be no one willing to take on the burden of
very system of capitalism. The American economy, the most powerful economy in the world, actually the most powerful economy that the world ever has ever seen, the most powerful engine, is based on a very basic principle. And that is that the productivity of society is assured by individuals laboring to achieve their own personal and selfish objectives. That's what capitalism is based on. Every person going after their own selfish objectives ultimately will benefit society as a whole. And we see it works, right? Capitalism works. It's a system that may not be perfect, but it works. So let's now look at text 4b. That underscores this concept, the capitalist concept.
It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interests.
Exactly. The very fact that we have food on the table. When the farmer in Minnesota is planting wheat for my bread, he's not thinking about me in California and I need to feed my kids. He's thinking about the need to feed his own kids. And as a trickle-down result, I'm able to feed my kids. That's the way it works.
Capitalism is the worst form of government, except for all the others.
Exactly. Winston Churchill said that. So even if the primary motive for work were to help others, in other words, let's say it was to help other people, in essence, work is alien to who we really are. And no matter what pleasures people find in work, whatever selfish reasons they find for working, it's still fundamentally different from who we are. Let's look at text 5.
And what then is the alienation of labor? First, in the fact that labor is external to the worker, i.e. does not belong to his nature, that therefore he does not realize himself in this work, and himself in it. But he does not feel at ease in it, but rather unhappy. That he does not develop any free physical or mental energy, but rather mortifies his flesh and ruins his spirit. The worker, therefore, is only himself when he does not work, and in his work he feels outside himself. He feels at home when he is not working, and when he is working, he does not feel at home. His labor is therefore not voluntary, but forced labor. It is therefore not a gratification of the needs, but only a means to satisfy needs outside himself.
By a good Jew. Karl Marx, right? One of our famous sons.
Seems like that's a totally dismal view of life.
But you know, he was, whatever you say about him, stupid he wasn't.
No.
And he kind of, in a certain sense, he understood human nature. Okay? He made a fatal mistake in thinking that he can change human nature. He thought that he can create a utopian world where people would actually change and be able to live in a utopian society, which runs contrary to human nature. So it was a fatal mistake, but he was onto something.
But he wanted to improve the society also.
Well, he basically understood that people at heart
don't want to work. I think it's really satisfying.
How do you define it?
You can be satisfied to accomplish something, and all the things we just discussed hold true as well. But his work, in essence, what he's saying here is as follows: that you may work, and you may be happy with the results of your work. But in essence, you're not working for yourself and your own objectives. The very definition of you working means that it removes the freedom for you to do exactly what you want to.
Yeah, you sell your time.
Yeah,
but
remember,
you
huh?
What if
you want to do it?
Fine,
right.
Labor conditions are
worse than far worse than
today.
Huh?
Even though it's no longer the park.
What if you're the boss?
even if you're the boss, right? If at any given time you have to interact with a scenario, that you weren't expecting, you'd rather not be doing it. Yet you're going to do it because that's what's necessary to do as your boss, as a boss. In other words, any vocation you're going to take upon yourself, it can be even 90% or 95% smooth, but there's going to be a small percentage where you're going to do things that are not what you want to do, as a result of the fact that you're working and you have to accomplish something. So, in summarize everything we've discussed till now. The classical perspective of work is basically two things. One, it's motivated by various personal interests. Okay? And number two, ultimately, regardless of how important those personal interests are and what you're accomplishing, work remains outside the human being's inner life and essential core. So we have these two basic ideas that we've discussed up until now, which is underscored by Marx and other people who, Henry David, how do you pronounce that?
Thoreau.
Hire someone who works not for money but for love. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher that we expect dinner, but is regard to his own interests, Adam Smith. And all these other people basically are underscoring the same idea, which is that we do things for selfish purposes, but ultimately when we do it, it's not who we are. It still, on some level, always remains external.
Well, I don't know. I kind of disagree. Because you're saying it's not at your core, but you can't have your cake and eat it. It can't be both. It's one or the other. In other words, if you're doing it for selfish reasons, because you need it to earn your daily bread,
right,
then that's part of your core. Because without your living, then
part of your core, but is it your core? In other words, if I ask you, Steve Pro, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to tell me a mortgage
expert?
No,
it's not my job.
Is that going to be your answer?
No.
What are you going to tell me? You're going to start telling me that you're a kind person.
Yeah.
You're a loving son. You're a good friend. So is your work the core of who you are? Most people will answer that way. Well, if I ask you, who are you really? Well, people say, oh, I'm
a person.
Yeah, but I agree with that. I agree with that. But what I'm saying is, to enable all that to enable your physical body, you need to have a certain amount of wealth.
Absolutely.
So that's in your nature, in your own selfish best interest, to make that so. So to say that's against your nature, it's not against your nature, it's part of your nature. It's not your whole core.
Well, I agree with that.
No.
I agree with that.
So it's in your nature.
In your nature to need to to need to accomplish for a variety of reasons, and we discussed them, whether it's to put food on the table, whether it's to avoid boredom, whether it's to find friendship, whether it's to whatever it may be. But at the end of the day, all these things remain a little alien. They're not the core of who you are. So now let's shift over to the Torah perspective. How does Judaism view the need to work? How does Judaism view work, period? So there's a radical approach here. Something that is different from what we've discussed till now, and something that, quite frankly, is not really discussed in any of these great philosophers or writings, so on and so forth. And this radical approach is, number one, that work in and of itself is that work is an end to itself. Work itself holds intrinsic value. Number two, that work is essential to the core of our being. How do we know this? Well, let's look at text 6a.
Man was born to toil.
Very simple. Job, the book from the Torah, says this is the purpose of man, to toil, to work hard. Now let me ask you a question. On the Jewish calendar, what is the most important day of the week?
Shabbat,
7th day of the week. But interestingly enough, before the Torah tells us about this most important, special day, it's one of the Ten Commandments, to honor and keep the Sabbath. the Torah quantifies it and says something else of equal importance, which teaches us that they are, in essence, equal in value. Let's look at text 6b.
6 days you shall work and perform all your labor, but on the seventh day is a Shabbat to the Lord. Your God, you shall perform no labor.
So in essence, what the Torah is telling us here is something profound. That in order for you to truly honor the seventh day, you must have worked the previous six. If you did nothing on the previous 6 days, you are not really honoring the Sabbath. They're interdependent on each other. Let's look at text 6c.
6 days shall you work, Rabbi Yehuda said. This is a separate decree, for just as Israel was commanded the mitzvah of Shabbat, so were they commanded to work.
Equal importance. Now we're going to take this even one level further. 2 weeks ago we discussed the concept of the tabernacle, the Mishkan. How God said that you should create a physical building for me to dwell in. And how we extrapolated from that, that in essence it means that we should create a temple within every single one of our hearts. Within every human being is a living temple. But the terminology that's used when God commands the Jewish people to create this temple, which is a central focal point for the people, the Torah clearly states that the only way you can accomplish this is through physical labor. If God wanted a dwelling place, he could have just shazammed it into being, right? No. I want you to work for it. I want you to work, and then after you complete your work, will there be an edifice for the divine spirit? And in essence, he's saying that that same idea applies to the edifice that we're creating within our hearts. It's only through labor, through work, that we can create a divine a divine presence within our being. Let's look at text 6d.
Rabbi Elazar ben Arsalia said, labor is so special that God did not rest his presence on Israel until they labored. As it said, they shall make me a sanctuary and I will dwell in them.
So work in essence is God conceived. Oh, look at that. Moving. Work in essence is God conceived, God given. And we're commanded to work just as we are commanded to keep the Shabbat. And therefore we should love work and we should embrace it. It all sounds very good, very nice. But in essence there's a major contradiction that we have to deal with. And that is that Judaism tells us that we have a responsibility to be divine beings. We're created to serve God. We're created to be spiritual entities. We're physical human beings that are meant to transform the world into a spiritual entity. Work seems to be the very antithesis of that. It basically sucks out our energy in doing anything but focusing on divinity, focusing on God. If our purpose is to transform this world into a divine place, then we should be sitting and studying the spiritual books all day. That's what we should be doing. But no. I want you to work. I want you to do whatever it is that you need to do, which by definition means I'm not going to be able to focus on making myself into a more spiritual being. So there seems to be a contradiction. On one hand, God wants us to pursue spirituality. On the other hand, God says, no, you were born to toil. Which one is it? Was I born to toil or was I born to be to become a spiritual creature?
The toil is spiritual.
So how do we reconcile these two ideas? Yeah.
So toil means both spiritual and physical.
But when it says that man is born to toilet doesn't mean spiritual. It means that he's meant to get up and whatever it is he does, you know.
I keep remembering what I think when Moses is instructed to assemble the tabernacle, he's going, how can I do this? And God says, put your hands to work and I will do the rest.
Right.
So that's my answer to that, to your question for myself.
I think the toil is spiritual.
That
point,
is
the point of it. I mean, that's the point of the class. There's a spiritual aspect to it.
So
they're not mutually
exclusive. Let's go to the end. Let's go to text 7.
Oh, I think I'm reading.
Yeah.
Okay. His desire arose to create the worlds because the nature of the one who is good is to impart good to others. If there were no world, to whom would he impart goodness?
So this actually strengthens our question a little more before we get to the answer. That is, if God ultimately is good and he wants to impart goodness upon mankind, then why did he create us in such a way that would necessitate work? Why couldn't God just create us in such a fashion that everybody has what they need? Everybody has enough food to feed their family, everybody has shelter, everybody has exactly what they need. Why is it that God created, we're saying that God is good and God wants everything to be good for everyone, then what's the need? It seems almost antithetical.
You wouldn't value it unless you worked for it.
So that's part of what we're going to get at in a moment too. In other words, the question like Tevye and the fiddler on the roof, right? Would it be so bad in your master plan if you just, you know, threw me a little bone, made me a rich person? What's the big deal? Would it really make such a big difference? Why is it that we have this need to toil? And if a person doesn't work, ultimately, they don't have food to put on the table. So let's look at text 8.
That's the one you just said.
The continuation, exactly.
Oh.
So we can go to text 9a then.
Oh.
That was heavy.
Rob
Kahana said. So, one second, before we go, so the answer ultimately has to lie in this concept that work is both good and divine. In other words, based on the questions I've been asking till now, one, if God expects us to pursue spirituality and divinity, how can he then require of us to spend such a major part of our day doing what may seem to be the opposite thereof? So there must be something divine in work. Number two, if God is good and wants the best for us, then how can he require of us to get up every morning and literally break our backs to put food on the table? Why didn't he just give it to us? Why didn't he just give us exactly what we need? So there must be something good in this concept of work. So, the first thing is what Ruby just mentioned. First of all, there's a natural appreciation for something that is acquired through personal effort. A person would rather make do with less that is his more than a lot that is not his. In other words, a person would rather work and live off the fruit of their own labor versus just having everything they need for nothing. When you feel you worked for it, you accomplished. Like the story with the nobleman and the serf. Let's look at text 9a. This is a Talmudic dialogue that underscores this idea.
Rav Kahana said, a person wants one cow of his own rather than nine calving of itself.
Cow is a unit. It's a monetary unit.
Oh.
Well, actually, no, it's not a monetary unit. It's a dry goods unit. A cow is dry goods. It's like a bushel. So in other words, a person, the dialogue here is not important, but the background about, you know, the Talmud starts with a question about if somebody is given the task of watching somebody's silo or apple orchards. And while he's gone, the apples start going bad. Is he required to sell them and then give the money when the owner returns? Or maybe he's not allowed to, it's not his. How could you sell something that's not yours? It may go bad, but that's not your business. Right? You have no right to sell something that's not yours. So the problem goes back and forth. And one of the reasonings behind it was this, that the person ultimately would rather one portion of their own work versus nine of someone else's. So we enjoy work because it gives us a sense of dignity. Work allows us not to be dependent upon others. Also very important. Look at text 9b. Text 9b, Regina.
Rabbi Judah Bar Hanin says, one that eats from his fellow is ashamed to look at him.
So,
if you are, if you're not self sufficient, then you should be ashamed of yourself.
So, human nature is to be ashamed when you take, right? The most difficult thing is to ask. I'll give you an example. Example from
the lecture show at the beginning.
Right. I'll give you an example from what I do myself, right? In order to keep operations running, I have to fundraise. The most difficult thing is to sit and ask people, because we're wired to give. Right? That's a human nature. We're wired to want to give. You sit across from somebody and say, I need your help, I need you to give me. So then it's a very difficult thing. The only way I'm able to do it is by mentally walking in and understanding that by me asking someone of means to give me, that enables me then to give others, right? Enables me to help others who don't have. Enables me to give in other ways, to teach, to do this, to do that. So, in essence, although life itself is a gift from God, we have a natural desire to contribute to our own existence. It's an important point. A human has a natural desire to contribute to their own existence. So in essence, God is giving us now the ability to do so and to value our lives at a deeper level. God, in essence, is giving us the ability to value our own lives on a deeper level. So the greatness of all this is that not only does he give us life, but he ensures that the life that he gives us is then appreciated by making us be part of that very life, contribute, in other words. So now the question is that's an important point. Is it clear? Did I bring it across?
It's important that we're responsible for our own sustenance.
Exactly. So the question is why? Going back to the original question, why did God create us in such a way that our satisfaction is contingent upon work, toil, and labor? That our satisfaction is contingent upon our ability to give and produce versus take. Why are we wired that way? Good question. Anybody have any idea? So let's look at text 10.
Through this, people will become partners of God in the entire creation.
So our objective in essence is to partner with God, to become a creator, just like God. And that's what the gift of work does. It allows us to create. We're partnering with God.
But don't we taught that when we're born? We have no idea, we don't have anything, we just want to take, we just have needs.
We're going to get to that in a moment.
We just want to
the interesting.
Yeah.
Right, and I'm about to, we're going to get, let's look at figure 4-1.
You know, when you say that, you can't help but think Bernie Madoff wants to be the senior partner.
Uncle Bernie. Right, then I'm going to come back to what you just mentioned in a moment. The interesting contradiction of a human and animals. We're going to do a little comparison in a moment. But let's just look at figure 4-1. Ultimately, there are three levels of giving. Number one, give people everything they need. Two, give people the opportunity to feel self-sufficient. Three, give people the opportunity to be givers. So, if you remember in lesson 1, we discussed the concept of every single human being created in the divine image. And the way we reveal this divine image within is by giving, not merely taking, but being able to give. So, in addition to partnering with God regarding our own lives, we also partner with God to develop the universe as a whole. We work together to transform the universe so that divinity is revealed in all its various factions. Let's look at figure 4-2. Three ways in which we partner with God through work. One, we sustain ourselves and others. Two, we develop civilization and improve the physical world. And three, we reveal the divine essence inherent in all creation. Now what's interesting is if we, as Steve just mentioned before, let's compare a human to other creatures. There's one interesting little factoid about a human being. A baby human is the most defenseless, in essence, worthless creature on planet Earth. There is absolutely no creature that can do nothing and is 100% dependent upon its parents at within hours of birth. Any animal is able to do something. They're able to blend in, they're able to hide, they're able to do something. A human, huh? All a human child can do, they can cry to get their parents to come help them. That's about it. That's all. A human child is the most defenseless, least creature able to do the least. And for several months. It takes a few months before they can even crack a smile and make you think that they love you somehow. By that time, a baby monkey is climbing trees and a baby elephant's eating peanuts, you know? But looking at it, once a human develops, everything changes. There are four types of life in this world. The first one, arguably, is not life, it's a form of life, but that's inanimate objects, rocks, stones, earth. In order for them to receive sustenance, they have to do nothing. What does a rock need to do to live? Whatever molecules or atoms make needs pressure, exactly. Whatever atoms that makes up a rock, there's not much the rock has to do to keep itself in shape. Right? Next level is plant life. Plant life, right, doesn't have to move. All it has to do is be in the earth, maybe open up its petals to receive the sun, but the physical plant doesn't have to move to receive its sustenance. Next is animals. Animals need to work a little harder. Right, they gotta hunt, they gotta run away, somebody's after them, they gotta work a little harder to survive. Finally, you have humans. In order for us to survive, not only do we have to hunt, not only do we have to be careful, but once we get the food, we can't just eat it. We have to prepare it, we have to make it edible. The same deer that a lion catches, we have to spend another hour to prepare it before we can eat it. So, in essence, for us, we have to transform, perfect, and elevate in order for us to live. So our deepest pleasure is thus derived from producing. By God giving us a desire to work, God is giving us the capacity to be godly, to be like Him. So, in His kindness, God created us in such a way that we're not only recipients of His benevolence, but also we have the ability to give. And He elevates us to the level of being a partner with creation. The only creature on planet Earth that has that special prominence, that's the human being. So, to summarize, the Torah model is man is born to toil, which is about partnering with God through giving. That is a summary of what the Torah model of God, of work is. So now let's go to section C, a lifetime of work. So, if work were a means to an end, once one amasses enough money, in essence, what they should do is, the logical thing to do is what?
Stop working.
Stop working. It could be 25, it could be 35, it could be 45. It doesn't make a difference. Once you amass enough wealth and you've attained your goal, stop working. Relax and enjoy your labor. Torah, however, takes a different approach. It says work is central to life. Man was created to toil. It's a central element of who we are. So if that's the case, retirement in essence is inconceivable in this model. Since work equals life, and one never retires from life. So retirement then becomes out of the picture. In other words, there's always something productive for someone to do. Now this doesn't mean that you have to continuously do the same thing your entire life, right? When you're young, you have more energy, you're able to do even back-breaking labor, right? When you reach a certain age, you can transfer into something else. And then you reach another age, you can transfer into something else. That's okay.
The proof is in the any millionaire or billionaire, like Bill Gates,
they continue to work.
He has a need, even as wealthy as he is.
They go into philanthropy, which is arguably more difficult than running Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to solve the world's problems, that's a lot more difficult. Why would he do that? It defies logic. But you see, this is inherently built in to man. One must always be productive through his or her entire life. You may retire from your day job at 65, but you must continue doing other things and producing. It's the definition of who we are as human beings. Furthermore, this is also a very important concept that's often lost on people, and that is that the older a person gets, the more experience they have. And experience is a very valuable commodity, extremely. So people who are, say, of retirement age often can help out in other areas with the experience they have and be often more productive than they were when they were 35, simply because of the experience amassed over the years. And we see this time and again. So man, ultimately created to toil, never retires, according to the Torah model. We're now going to go to section 2, wealth and charity. What page are we on? 101, right? So let's talk a little first about the questions for discussion. If we're the motivation to work is to give and not only to take, so there are many ways that you can give and reveal godliness. But the most influential way to do this ultimately is through the money one earns. Why is that? So let's ask some questions for discussion. How would you describe money? Raise your hands. We're not going to go around. Anybody want to give it a shot? How would you describe it? power.
Right up there.
Huh?
Right there, buying,
buying power.
Okay, let's I'm going to use my green pen. Okay, buying power. What else?
The tool for converting labor into the acquisition of goods, services, and
into goods. Okay.
Not just goods, services. I don't want to say status, but you know, like your financial security or your something more than just goods and services.
Okay.
Commodity.
What else?
Means of comfort.
Comfort?
Mm-hmm.
Money?
I guess, yeah.
What about chocolate a bit? So money can be a lot of things, obviously. You know, if we sit and we can come up with many different things that money could be. But ultimately, money is similar to work. The same idea. It's there in order to transform us into givers and not just takers. Money, in essence, is there for us to collect in order for us to give. Now, we can give it in different forms. You can give it to your family members, you can give it to yourself for whatever reason, you can give it to others for their necessities as well. Let's look at 12 text 8.
King David says to God, Master of the universe, create equity in your world by making rich and poor the same. God replied, if such were the case, who would preserve kindness and truth? If all were rich or all were poor, who would be able to do acts of kindness?
This is a crazy idea. It's a very radical view. In essence, what God is telling King David is that the uneven distribution of wealth and diverse economic classes is important for the very structure of the world we live in. It's not merely a result of circumstances. One person's poor, one person's rich, one person's this, one person's that. God, in essence, is giving humans the opportunity to refine this material world. It gives us the opportunity to give, and everybody on some level is supposed to give in order to partner with God. You know, in Jewish custom, even if a person is poor, they're still required to give to someone else. There's nobody that's absolved from the need to give charity. Now, a mitzvah, a good deed, what page are we on? We're on page 102. Transforms our part of the world, right? That's the idea, the concept of a mitzvah. You transform your little segment of the world. Charity, ultimately, is considered in the Torah to be the greatest mitzvah of all. Why is that? Because there's another important element of money. Money is not just everything we just mentioned here. There's something more to it. You know, there's the famous Jack Benny joke. The guy gets held up, and the robber says, "Money or your life?" The guy's quiet. And the thief goes, "Money or your life?" And he's quiet. And the thief goes, "Money or your life?" And Jack Benny goes, I'm thinking, you know. So, what is it? It's a classic, you know. So, why is it that money plays such a central part in people's lives? And the answer is because you invest your total self, time, and your resources into making money. We put so much time and energy into bringing home that paycheck, into making a few dollars. That's why it's so difficult to give away, because it's your life. There's so much energy going into it, and now give it away.
You're giving away a bit of your life.
In essence, yeah.
Well, yeah,
that's what's happening. Right? So, I mean, just chalk it up, right? How much you make an hour, right? And then if you give that amount to charity, it means you just gave someone else that amount of hours of your life. It's a very difficult thing, like Mr. Bogolubov said, remember? He can explain every dollar he gave besides that first $10,000. He said he couldn't explain it. Because it ran contrary to his very fiber of his being. He said that he was just, you know, everything is about business. You know, you take in. That's the bottom line. It's profit. And suddenly, he had to give. It ran contrary to his nature. So the beauty, ultimately, of charity is you're doing something good with an element that, in essence, represents your entire life. And that's why charity plays such a fundamental role in Judaism. And in essence, many people wonder, you look at the world and you see that a disproportionate amount of charitable causes are supported by people of the Jewish faith. Disproportionate. Jews give disproportionately in compared to what they have and their numbers. And the reason is because this has been built into our psyche since the beginning of time, since the Torah was given, that charity is the most important element of the Torah. So let's look now at text 12b. And this is Maimonides. No, this is Rabbi Schneer's Almud Liadi. Page 102.
We can understand why our sages so greatly extolled the virtue of charity, declaring it equal to all other mitzvot combined. In all of the Jerusalem Talmud, charity is simply called mitzvah, for such was the idiomatic expression commonly used to refer to charity, a mitzvah, because charity is the core of all mitzvot of action and surpasses them all. This is so because the sole purpose of all mitzvot is to elevate one's life force to God, since it is this life force that performs them and is engaged in them. You will find no other mitzvah in which the life force is engaged to the same extent as in the mitzvah of charity. For in all other mitzvot, only one faculty of the life force applies itself, and only while the mitzvah is being performed. In the case of charity, however, which people give from the proceeds of their toil, all the energy of the life force is engaged in the work through which the money is earned. Thus, when they give this money to charity, their entire life force is elevated to God. Hence, the superiority of charity over all other mitzvot. Even those who give charity for money which they did not labor to earn, nevertheless, since they could have purchased with this money sustenance for their own life force, they are actually giving their life force to God. This is why our sages have said that charity hastens the redemption. For with one act of charity, one elevates much of the life force, more of its faculties and powers than might be elevated to the performance of many other mitzvot.
That's a very profound reading. Basically, he's underscoring what we mentioned, that money is your life. And when you give it, you are giving part of your life. That's a very important and fundamental idea. We're now going to go to section B, and we're going to talk about the 8 levels of charity. So now that we mentioned that the ultimate charity of God is that He allows us to maintain our dignity and self-respect by working and enabling us to give to others, so too when you give to charity, the degree of the degree of sensitivity involved when you are charitable is also important in order to allow the recipient to maintain dignity and self-respect as well. Again, just like God is charitable to us and allows us to maintain our dignity and self-respect, so too when you give to others, it's important to also maintain and keep in mind the dignity and self-respect of the receiver, the one you're giving to. And therefore, Maimonides lays out 8 different levels of giving charity. Let's read on text 13.
You should have done it the other way. From the least to the most.
Yeah, the top 10.
There are 8 levels of charitable giving, one higher than the other. The greatest level above which there is no greater is the support of 4 fellow Jews lying down hand with
I want to just mention that Maimonides actually says that responsibility is to Jew and Gentile alike. But if there are two needy people, you have to first give to your own family first, which is why he mentions a poor fellow Jew. But he himself says our responsibility is to everybody.
With a gift or loan, or entering into a partnership with him, or finding employment for him in order to assist him so that he no longer needs to be dependent upon others. The lesser level than this, to give charity to the poor without knowing to whom one gives, and without the recipient knowing from whom he receives, for this is performing a little soul for the sake of heaven. This is like the anonymous fund that existed in the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. There, the righteous gave in secret and the poor profited in secret. Giving to a charity fund is similar to this mode of charity. So one should not contribute to a charity fund unless one knows that the person appointed over the fund is a trustworthy, wise, and competent administrator. A lesser level than this is when one knows to whom to give, but the recipient does not know his benefactor. For example, the greatest sages used to walk about in secret and place money at the doors of the poor. It is worthy and truly good to do this. If those who are responsible for distributing charity are not so trustworthy. A lesser level than this is when one does not know to whom one gives, but the poor person does know his benefactor. For example, the greatest sages used to tie money to their cloth and throw them behind their back, and the poor would come and take the money out of the cloth, so that they would not be ashamed. A lesser level than this is when one gives the poor person directly to his hand, but before being asked. A lesser level than this is when one gives to the poor person after being asked. A lesser level than this is when one gives less than what one should, but gladly and with a smile. A lesser level than this is when one gives unhappily.
So basically, Maimonides lays out the eight different levels. But the important thing is that even if one gives on the lowest level, he or she is still elevating their soul by the mere fact that they give. So whatever level one person gives at, it's still the important thing is to give. So let's look at figure 4.3, charity, practical ways, bottom page 106. So what are practical ways that we can actually give charity? Number one is place a charity box or push cup on your office desk or in another conspicuous place and place money in it regularly. At the end of the week, distribute coins to all your employees or coworkers for them to contribute to charity of their choice. In other words, one thing is to give charity yourself, another thing is to encourage other people to give charity as well. And the Rebbe used to do this all the time. He used to tell people to fix a charity box in their kitchen, to put one in their office, as a blessing for your place of work. By the mere fact that you're giving charity, you're bringing blessing into your home or work. And equally important, he would give people dollars and say, you give this to charity, encouraging other people to give as well. So let's now go to section 3, working in good faith. So Torah's view is that we partner with God, and by partnering with God, we are motivated to use our wealth in positive ways. The problem is that too often we lose sight of the partnership. A, because work has its physical demands. It's difficult. Long hours, and there's no time often for study and prayer. You know, we all know you get home, you're exhausted. You just don't have time to focus on the spirituality of it all. And work, in many ways, specifically, people who are in the white-collar environment, challenges our ethical and moral values every single day. It's a big challenge. You know, we're often in situations where we can take advantage of others without them knowing. And we're often in... People are in business, can do things that are, you know, maybe on the gray area, could or could not be okay. These are things that we're challenged with every single day. So in essence, it makes it more difficult to tap into the divine beauty of work. And finally, the very fact that you're partnering with God can lead you to arrogance and pride. I'm a creator. I'm just like God. That itself can lead us, can blind us to the mission. So therefore, text 14 gives us some practical applications to how we are meant to always remember the objective of work, and how to continuously remind ourselves of what's important. But text 14.
A very wise man once said, wealth has three evils. Firstly, most people attain it through forbidden means. Secondly, even if it was attained in ways that are permitted, it will likely be spent on something forbidden. Lastly, the person will forget God and say, is my strength and the might of my hands that has accumulated this wealth for me.
So, often you see that financial success can distort people's priorities. And we see this actually in the Torah itself. When the Jewish people were about to come into the land of Israel, two of the tribes on the eastern shore of the Jordan, Gad and Reuven, saw that it's much greener, the grass is greener on the other side. They saw beautiful pastures. And over the Jordan River, it didn't look as nice. So they turned to Moses and said, look, let's hang out, let us settle the land here on this side, and let everybody else go into the land of Israel. We'll come, we'll protect, we'll serve as a bulwark against enemies, and we'll even join the war if need be. We'll come into the land of Israel, but there's great pastures here. It would be a shame if, you know, we go into the land. Let's just stay here. So they go to Moses. Let's look at text 15a. They approach him.
They approached Moses and said, we will build sheepfolds here for our livestock and cities for our children. We will then arm ourselves quickly and go before the children of Israel until we have brought them to their place. Our children will reside in the fortified cities to protect them from the inhabitants of the land.
And now look what Moses responds. Continue more. 15b.
Build yourselves cities for your children and enclosures for your sheep.
The difference between 15a and 15b, when they approach Moses, what was the first thing they mentioned? Business, money. Next thing is their children in the future. That was a secondary thing. What was Moses' response? He said, folks, think about the future first. Business is second. Get your priorities straight. Many times, money, wealth, clouds our vision, doesn't allow us to look at the true priorities, as we see in 15c.
The tribes Reuben and Gad made what was of prime importance secondary, and what was of secondary importance prime. In what way? They cherished their possessions more than their lives. They first told Moses, we will build sheepfolds for our livestock here. And only afterwards did they say, we will build cities for our children. Moses said to them, don't do it this way. First do what is of prime importance, build cities for your children, only afterwards build enclosures for your sheep. God said to them, you cherish your possessions more than your lives. I affirm that there can be no blessing in this.
So the point of these three readings is that if one loses sight of the partnership with God in business and in your work, in essence, it's only a matter of time before it can lead to a breakdown of moral and ethical values. Text 16, interesting text.
You want one who wants bread should eat it with the blade of a sword.
Anybody want to try to understand that one?
I was hoping you could explain it.
Yeah. It's in the Zohar. It says if you want bread, you have to eat it on the blade of a sword. What does that mean? What it means is that when it comes to the physical elements, we must always maintain our guard. Right? Eating is a base necessity. But if a person eats for the only purpose of eating, is for self-enjoyment, then they're in trouble. If a person eats because they know that they need to eat in order to do something greater, in order to be healthy, to be a productive member of society, then they're doing something right. So what he's saying is you must always be on guard when you eat. When you deal with the base necessities of a human, always be on guard. And the same thing applies to business. Same thing applies to work. We always have to be cognizant of the pitfalls of getting caught up in work for a variety of reasons. Whether it's you get caught up and you think that this work is nothing more than to make money so that I can live, end the story. That's a pitfall. When people can get blinded and lose their moral bearings by wealth or many other things. And same thing can apply. So therefore it's important to always focus on the true purpose of work. And we have to maintain our integrity despite all the workplace challenges. And we discussed there are many, many challenges in the workplace. Yet we still have to maintain our integrity because we know what the true reason for all of it is. We have to balance, and balancing these things is a very delicate dance. And the real bottom line of all of it is our partnership with God. And a biblical example of this would be Joseph. Joseph, unlike all our other forefathers, was not just a shepherd who sat and studied all day. He went to Egypt. He was actually the first Jewish accountant. First thing he became was an accountant, right? He was the money counter for the prison guard. And then later, he went to prison and the whole story. He became the viceroy of Egypt. He was a very powerful man. Very different than all the other forefathers that we adore. But how was he able to keep his morality and his bearings through all of that? Remember, Egypt was far from a moral society. How was he able to do it? Because he never became bitter or broken. He always maintained his optimistic view of life, and he always maintained his morality and his ethical values. So, same thing is to build practical reminders into our own lives not to lose view of the greater objective. And the various ways to do this is one of the things we mentioned is to take a day of rest, right? In order for work to be meaningful and productive, you have to stop at one point. You have to turn it all off and focus on your family, focus on your friends, focus on your spirituality, pray, do things that are important for your spiritual self. In essence, that's integral to being able to be a positive member of the workforce. Number two is every day to take a few minutes off, whether it's in the morning before you start to pray a little, put on tefillin, right? Or maybe midday, there's a prayer called mincha. You take a few minutes and you just reevaluate the day and stop so you can continue and do what's right. So in conclusion, work and money, what's that? How did he get in there? Oh, there. Okay. So in conclusion, work and money present a great challenge to our moral and spiritual integrity. Work and money also present us with an unprecedented opportunity to partner with God. So when you go to work tomorrow, you have to think about your goals in a new way. And everybody does something, everybody has to work continuously to be a productive, to continue producing. You have to transform your workplace into an environment of kindness and goodwill. Be nice, smile at a coworker, at your boss even, if you need to. And work hard to succeed, the scoundrel, huh? With the goal being to partner with God. And you have to ultimately ask yourself, am I using my resources to make a positive difference? If the answer is yes, then ultimately you're on your way towards a more meaningful life. Key points for tonight. One, there are various motives for work. From the classical perspective, work is a means to receive, and work itself is not integrated with the core of human being. Torah asserts that people are born to toil. That is part of their essential core. Hence, we are commanded to work. Three, God created the world in order to bestow kindness upon people. The requirement that human beings work is a kindness as well, allowing us to better appreciate our lives. Four, the ultimate good is for man to become a partner with God in his creation. This is achieved through the toil to sustain life, to develop the resources of the universe, and to sublimate the world. In the Torah model, it is incumbent for one to partner with God by being a giver, regardless of one's age or financial circumstances. We never retire from life. And sixth, the mitzvah of charity is most effective in elevating our personal lives and the world around us. Seven, engaging in work poses unique challenges in that one must fully engage with the physical world. We must take heed not to lose sight of the divine objective, and the mitzvah of Shabbat and the Mincha prayer are good ways to ensure we remain focused on the real purpose of work, to partner with God and to elevate ourselves and the world around us. That's pretty much it for tonight. Thanks for joining. And I look forward to seeing everybody next week. We continue the dialogue. Good night, I'll see you.
Yeah, tenants.